Spark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby.
We are fueled by your support. You make CJSF.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Hale, and with me as per usual is Brandon.
I'm talking about Marc Andreessen's manifesto, the Techno-Optimist Manifesto.
Before we jump right into it, though, we both have quandaries, but I was watching a YouTube video by Too Lazy to Try, who, you know, makes these little kind of compilations and commentary videos on drama that's going on in various areas of discourse. Usually it has to do with, like, you know, podcasters and political figures and people kind of in a lot in the media. I think people like, you know, Joe Rogan or presidential candidates or, you know, famous people, you know, who are trying to talk out of turn or whatever subject and all that kind of stuff. And he was doing an episode covering a bunch of drama that's apparently going on between Ben Shapiro, another sort of kind of right-wing journalist type guy, and Piers Morgan, another, you know, well-known, you know, big-name journalist. It was kind of about how all these sorts of people, Piers, you know, Ben Shapiro and Piers Morgan and a bunch of other sort of adjacent figures like that are all upset with each other and how they're not going on each other's shows and all this drama in between all of them. It really made me think a lot about, like, realms of public discourse, because on some level, I started to ask myself, like, obviously there are some people watching these people. Like it's not like there's literally nobody watching them, right? Like, I'm sure they have a bigger audience than us. But they certainly don't seem to be at the center of anything going on. And I kind of, the point is this, I'm like, who's listening to these people? You know, like who cares what Ben Shapiro or Piers Morgan or whoever thinks? And it almost seems like in their own content, they're somewhat self-aware of that, that their grasp of the being an important place of public discourse is sort of fading away. Like, look, all publicly centered discourse is public discourse, but obviously some voices are louder than others and some conversations are more important, you know, at a given time and space and, you know, considering certain events. And it just seems like so much of what we call mainstream media is further and further slipping into being kind of irrelevant and, like, just babbling at each other. For lack of a better way of saying it, like, it's come down to, like, the point where their primary stories are themselves arguing with each other.
Yeah, no, I get what you mean, right? There's this kind of, like, I think irrelevant is the right word, but that's so broad. In this regard, it's sort of like self-perpetuating or self-contained. Like, if people like Ben Shapiro or Piers Morgan, like, had any direct impingement on the world, their speech could actually, like, refer to something, right? But in this case, them talking is just referring to their talking to themselves or to each other, right? And so it's, like, kind of self-referential, and in that way it's kind of like spinning its wheels, because we can ask, like, okay, well, usually, like, one of the very, like, naive kind of definitions of language is that language is stuff that refers to stuff other than itself, right? Like, if I point at something and say, like, if I point at a cat and I say, that's a cat, the language is being used to refer to the cat that I'm pointing to, right? Not to the words themselves. And we usually think that philosophy is reflexive because it's language use, investigating language use and stuff like that. But in this case, it kind of seems like that self-referentiality is turned back on itself. And it's not even like self-investigating or anything like that. It's just kind of empty and vapid. Now, I guess your quandary in this regard is like, okay, well, how can something like this happen, right? Not just in the sense of like, okay, well, how is self-reflection or anything like that, or self-referentiality possible, but more so like, how can something like a media institution or particular, like, because these are, you know, this is kind of like, we think of different things when we use terms like practices or institutions, something a bit more like grand or you know, embedded in our everyday lives, right? Things that we do. But media is an institution. It's a practice we engage in, right? But how can something like this just refer to itself in a way when it's supposed to be at the service of communicating things or exploring ideas or something like that? And not only that, there's like a very unique sense in which this kind of like virtual discussion is empty, you know, in almost like a, you might gesture at in things of like postmodernism or something like that, where it's just completely virtual, right? It doesn't have any reference to anything but itself.
Yeah. And even with the YouTuber himself, too lazy to try, it seems like the primary message or like the lifting point for, you know, what's the kind of the point of watching this is to kind of mock and watch these people that nobody really cares about have drama amongst themselves, right? And so in that sense, even the creator in a sense is almost a little bit parasitic. He's almost like parasitic on a dying corpse a little bit. Like, it's sort of like look at how like lame and stupid and dumb like these people are. Like, they're totally, you know, they're 10, 20, 30 years behind. And like, you know, they're all just making fools of themselves, arguing about nothing and having no impact. And that's correct. But it also allows for, you know, more present forms of media, more presently minded people to kind of like take bits and pieces of that corpse to make something out of it too. Right? Like, it's like, oh, well, it's the drama is still drama, whether or not.
Yeah. Yeah. It's content, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's become contentified.
Yeah, it's content, and you can kind of push that, right? And it gets clicks and whatnot. Because in a certain way, there is, like, a thrill to engaging with that. I think that's an important element of this, too, that it's good that you bring that up. It's not just that it's two people, like Piers Morgan and Ben Shapiro, going back and forth, talking to each other in this, like, empty way. It actually, like, there's a person setting that scenario up, right? That might not even really be what's going on. It's just that there is a sort of like contemporary narrative that is being spun by a YouTuber here in a quasi like historical way, casting them as already irrelevant. So there's already that kind of judgment that comes with, you know, evaluation that a historian might make. Their worth it within the kind of narrative that we have. But the emptiness is itself being propped up as something to engage with, right? That they don't have anything to say anymore. And for some reason, the medium through which this is being given to you, you know, algorithmic, present media, through the internet, somehow nothing can be content on this medium.
It's true.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to get a little bit more into this, honestly. It made me think about some things to bring up as we go forward with our, you know, very tech-focused episode. But you have a quandary as well, so why don't we cover that, and then we'll jump back in.
Sure, yeah. So my quandary, it might be two. I'm going to talk about the first one. Maybe I'll save the other half of this for the next episode, but they both concern advertising. So I like to think about advertising sometimes because it's not something that I'm like usually in the face of. I do a pretty good job of filtering out, you know, ads and stuff on my like internet experience or whatever. So when I do encounter ads, I kind of have fresh eyes to it, right? It's not something that I'm numb to. So one of the kind of things that I've noticed about advertising is that when we see an ad, usually we think of ads as like trying to tell us, you know, some new information, like we see a special going on or there's some sale or something like that, right? And we kind of tell ourselves, or we like rationalize the omnipresence of ads in our society as, well, this is how information is transmitted, right? This is how companies market. They get the word out for things, right? And in a part, that is true, right? But at the same time, it's not just doing that. And there's one very good example of why that can't be true. And it is Coca-Cola, right? So Coca-Cola is the most known, is probably like the most known product on Earth. I think that basically every language other than like in English we have pop, soda, but you use cola as like a ubiquitous term for like a carbonated beverage. And except for like a few languages adjacent to English, basically every other language uses cola for what we would in Canada would call pop.
Right? Yeah, and Coca-Cola is, from my understanding, is one of the best known English terms in the entire world.
It's like the word okay, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it has what we call, you know, sticking power, like brand recognition, right? So if that's the case, if Coca-Cola is so well known, why, and the purpose of advertising is to get the word out, why is Coca-Cola still the largest spender in marketing, right? Because you would think, well, the job's done. Everyone knows about Coca-Cola. It's ubiquitous. So the point of advertising, yeah, exactly. So the point of advertising can't just be to get the word out. It has to be something else. Otherwise, Coca-Cola is just burning money, right? So that's part of the quandary, but that has always been like the lead up for me thinking about what advertising really is doing, which is I've termed it like the installation and the maintenance of desire through the construction of a social context, because you only desire something socially like a commodity within a social context. So that's why their ads are not really like trying to sell you on the taste of it or anything like that, or not trying to inform you of anything new. They're just kind of showing you these vague images of like, you know, good times that you can have, because it has to be within the context of those narratives in which you desire it, right? It has to remain socially relevant, and advertising maintains that social relevance, or else you'll start caring about other beverages like water, you know, that is like probably better, like absolutely is just better for you to like drink on the daily, right?
Well, and I think part of that is my mind immediately goes to the fact that like all cultural items are in some sense, you know, they're synthetic creations, right? They are creations of culture, and they need to be. I like how you use the word maintenance, and it makes me think about, I said, as you pointed out, that Coca-Cola as a term is one of the best known English terms in the entire world. I know one of the other ones is the term Titanic, referring obviously to the ship Titanic and the sinking and the disaster and all this kind of stuff, right? And in a very different but also very similar way, a same sort of thing has happened, where it's like, look, there was an actual ship, the Titanic. It sunk. There was this whole big event. It was a big deal. That cultural item has been continued to be passed down through media, all sorts of different, you know, mediums synthetically for well over 100 years now. And it's still one of the best known terms, and as such, one of the best known cultural items in the entire world, all because it's been carried through the century, right? Now, like Coca-Cola, they sort of like, they do the maintenance themselves. Like they obviously, they know people are talking about Coca-Cola, people recognize Coca-Cola, but as you said, if they just did no advertising, if they were just like, all we're going to do is manufacture Coca-Cola and that's it, well, it probably would start to lose its luster, right? Like, you know, if we were to jump another 100 years from now, and for some reason we just stop making Titanic content, whether it's movies or documentaries or tattoos or whatever it's going to be, you know, for whatever reason it just stops. Well, in 100 years, people aren't going to feel the same way about this term Titanic, wherever they are in the world.
Yeah, and what's important for me is that it's not just that it's going to, like, it's going to fall out of memory or anything like that. That's true. But what that actually looks like and what Coca-Cola wants to do is maintain not just the memory of it, but the social contexts within which you can desire, right? Because desire has to be within a context, because desire is always kind of furnished by a fantasy, and a fantasy is a narrative, and you need those narrative fantastic spaces in order to desire, right? Like when you want a car, you don't want a car because you want a car. You want a car because other people want you to want a car, right? I'm not a car person, but I can still construct fantasies of wanting a Lamborghini or a Bugatti
Or even just the fact of, like, when you think about, okay, well, what will a car allow me to do? We have ideas and presumptions around how a vehicle allows you to operate in our current culture, whether that's as a signifier or for you to be able to do certain things, which are ultimately going to be signifiers themselves. You know, like, think about something like van life or road tripping or whatever that's so popular, especially with, you know, people in our kind of age group, right? Like, that's a thing that you can only do with a vehicle, right? So if you want to be the kind of person that does that and participates in all that kind of stuff, then you have to believe in and participate in the car vehicle narrative, right? And I think I think Coca-Cola is an interesting example because, like, I think there are a lot of parallels with the Titanic example as well that I brought up. But the interesting thing about Coca-Cola, kind of getting into our main topic, is Coca-Cola is a multi-billion dollar, very active, giant corporation, right? Like, it is not a dead cultural item that's being picked up by individuals and kind of carried further. It's being carried forward as a cultural item by the community and the culture, and that's also being propelled, perpetuated, and controlled in some instances by a very active living Coca-Cola entity, i.e. like Coca-Cola Incorporated, or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's big pop. Yeah, there's moneyed interests in this. No, yeah, I mean, because they want to keep their product relevant and people desiring it, right? And if you maintain that institution of Coca-Cola, I think that's the main thing for me, is like Coca-Cola is kind of an institution and it's evinced by its being known in that way. And it has social context, just like pure like Coca-Cola social context in a certain way. And that's how... if you can maintain that, then it's good for business in a very like profoundly rooted way in like consumer culture, literally.
Well, getting on to all that kind of consumer, billionaire culture, all that, we are going back to our main event for the night, which is the Techno Optimist Manifesto by Marc Andreessen. And this was posted to the Andreessen Horowitz website, I believe it's his website, his blog or whatever, a couple years ago on October 16th, 2023. So it's relatively recent. And we're going to read through a little bit here of it. But real quick, before we say anything, just want to say for our listeners who Marc Andreessen is. Newsflash, he's a billionaire guy, he's a billionaire tech bro. He is, according to Wikipedia, he is an American businessman, venture capitalist, and former software engineer. He's the co-founder of Mosaic, a early web browser, and he was the co-founder of Netscape, if people remember that. And then he was also the co-founder and one of the main partners of the venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz, which is worth many billions. And he is involved with Hewlett Packard, another big, you know, tech and arms manufacturer, and he's also a close friend of Mr. Donald Trump, the president and chief, and is well known in the tech industry and is worth, according to Wikipedia, however accurate that is, about $2 billion. So someone who is very much, well, I've heard of Mark Andreessen before this. He's quite, there's a lot of these, you know, kind of tech, you know, soup billionaire bro type guys. He's someone I've certainly heard of before, and he's also someone who's publicly quite vocal. And I think this is one of his more well-known pieces that he's kind of ever put out there. So we thought it would be a good kind of thing to go through because it really illustrates a lot about his or their ideology, ideally. We'll see, kind of.
Yeah, it certainly encapsulates an ideology. I mean, I think it's... And it's one that obviously they are sort of writing about and espousing. I find it interesting in terms of, like, when we think of the Silicon Valley kind of tech bro come up, you have someone who invents a product, and that product kind of captures or implements a vision that a person has, right? But Mosaic and Netscape were pretty early software, you know, innovations. Like, Netscape was one of the first web browsers that, like, a graphical web browser. So if you go and use the internet, you know, you browse whatever website that you're going on, you're using a web browser for that. So Netscape was the first one of that. I don't think of someone who invents the web browser as someone who has, like, some kind of, I guess, agenda to push, like with Mark Zuckerberg or something, where he thinks that we need to bridge this gap between the internet and real life. Maybe there was some kind of like hidden philosophy for him where he wanted to open up the internet to make it more accessible. And in that way, it was kind of, you know, that's a laudable thing. But how you get from someone who opens up the internet using a graphical interface to a venture capitalist who is going to talk about, you know, overcoming sort of techno-pessimism or something like that. That's a little bit of a head scratcher for me. I guess the capital or the venture capitalist aspect of it probably has more to do with it than the actual tech background, though. But we'll see. We'll talk about it.
Well, why don't we start? We'll start off. It's split into a number of very kind of ominously titled subsections. It's quite short, but why don't we read each section and then we'll kind of go through. So the first section, I just want to say there's a bunch of quotes at the top. I'm going to skip the quotes. They're just openers. They're fine. Let's get to Mark Andreessen's own words and not listen to Thomas Edison and Mary and Toby. So the first section is called Lies. So Mark starts off with this. We are being lied to. We are told that technology takes our jobs, reduces our wages, increases inequality, threatens our health, ruins the environment, degrades our society, corrupts our children, impairs our humanity, threatens our future, and is ever on the verge of ruining everything. We are told to be angry, bitter, resentful about technology. We are told to be pessimistic. The myth of Prometheus in various updated forms, like Frankenstein, Oppenheimer, the Terminator, haunts our nightmares. We are told to denounce our birthright, our intelligence, our control over nature, our ability to build a better world. We are told to be miserable about the future. So that's the first section under lies, kind of ominous, very, very little, a little bit Nietzsche-y. Also bringing in some, you know, the Prometheus there, some classic Greek, you know, mythos into it. Right off the hop, my initial thing whenever I read anything like this is, who is telling you all this stuff,
Mark? Yeah, this is going to kind of it's going to be part of the package with any kind of manifesto like this, where it it feels to me less like the goal is to have some kind of identifiable ideological enemy, and it's more to actually manufacture it. Because you can, if you think about, you know, the vibe or the general zeitgeist, you can definitely tell where something like this is being cribbed from. You know, we are told that technology takes our jobs, reduces our wages, blah, blah, blah. You can, and if you think about the discourse around, say, generative AI, you can certainly cite that as a place where people are saying, look, generative AI is being implemented in order to take certain people's jobs, automate certain people's jobs, right? So there you have at least not like an actual person who is saying this, but you can cite a discourse where something like this is happening, right? A discourse in the generative AI kind of discussion. But the point of that is not, the point of this is not actually to try and discuss that discourse and like to weigh the arguments or whatever. And it's not even necessarily to like, it's trying to conflate a lot of different, a bunch of different like zeitgeists around that kind of thing into a vague but articulable enemy, right? Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, and I think that's the big thing, is right off the hop to get, like, very mildly meta about the pieces. This is an interesting work because I do think that there's probably some genuine feelings there they're putting out there. It's also very clearly a piece of propaganda. So he, like, this is a something that was released to the public that was put out, you know, on Twitter, on social media for millions of people to see, millions of people have read it. You and I, like, there was something that we looked at, you know, a little bit as well, something called the Powell Memo, which is a kind of similar vibe document in some ways, much more dry, but from the 70s, which sort of talked about how, like, there's left-wing and union powers and, you know, very advocating some similar directions, but 50 years ago, that was a secret document that was circulated amongst actual power brokers and was leaked. This, however, was intentionally leaked by its creator. So you have to ask, why is that? And immediately, part of it is this narrative of putting this narrative out there that we are under threat, that we're at war, that we're being, you know, shackled, held down. People love that kind of story. People love narratives. They love that kind of narrative. But it's also always like, Mark, you are a billionaire with an immense amount of power and like operate in these fields of AI and doing all this kind of stuff. Like, it's like you're writing as if like you're hiding in a closet, you know, from like the Gestapo being like, you know, they're coming for us, like they're stopping us from existing, blah, blah, blah. It's like, no. You typed this out on your private jet.
It very much so has that feeling like that. It very much starts from that like reactionary place of like, this is what they took from you. But it's sort of preempting that by saying this is what people want to take away from you. But that stuff hasn't been taken away from Mark Andreessen. In fact, Mark Andreessen owns more than the people this is addressing, right?
Yes. Yes, yeah. Almost certainly. You know, it's we are told to denounce our birthright, our intelligence, our control over nature, our ability to build a better world. I think this is a theme that's going to come up a lot, and some other individuals who have looked at this essay have brought up, which is there's a, I think, read between the lines Darwinianism going on, a kind of, evolutionary Darwinism going on here, where, you know, our birthright, our intelligence, our control over nature, our ability to build a better world. When you say our who, right, like, who are you specifically talking about? Because I don't think he's talking about everybody, as much as he may say that later or whatever. I do think that this is a perspective that's coming from a very select group of people who have very particular views about and ideas about what they're capable of and what they should be allowed to do in terms of what they're capable of.
Yeah, I think addressing the, so that's sort of one thing that is always commented on in different discussions of this is the repeated use of we and our and you know, they are, we, you know, we are being told. So like these very indefinite entities, and even the sort of ad, like the group being